Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the apparent reversal on the part of Turkey, which up until now has appeared indifferent to the plight of Syrian Kurds under siege by the Islamic State in the border town of Kobani. David Phillips, a foreign affairs expert and former senior advisor to the United States Department of State in the administrations of Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama, and author of The Kurdish Spring, A New Map of the Middle East, joins us to discuss whether Turkey's decision to allow Kurdish fighters and weapons to cross into Syria from Turkey is cosmetic or represents a strategic shift, given that Turkey still will not allow the U.S. to use the NATO airbase nearby at Incirlik in Turkey. Then we'll look into the exaggerated fear and paranoia being stoked by the media over two cases of Ebola in the United States, while little attention and focus is being applied to West Africa, where 5,000 have died and where the source of the Ebola outbreak is located and must be contained before the disease is allowed to spread further. Roxanne Silver, a professor of psychology and social behavior, medicine and public health at the University of California, Irvine, joins us to discuss comparisons with the hysteria generated by the media over the Boston Marathon bombings that she studied, which found that individuals who were exposed to a great deal of the media reported more acute stress than did people who were actually at the marathon. Then finally, Henri Barki, who served on the State Department's policy planning staff dealing with the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence, joins us to discuss why Turkey has been so reluctant to get involved militarily in Syria while still insisting that the removal of the Assad regime should be the number one priority, at the same time appearing to be in denial about the extent to which Turkey turned a blind eye to the creation of the Islamic State, which they helped facilitate. Before we begin, I'd like to invite you to the Use of the Hammer Forum. I'm hosting this coming Thursday, October the 23rd at 7:30 p.m., tackling climate change nationally and globally. Despite the overwhelming scientific consensus that global warming is a danger to the planet, little progress has been made to reduce CO2 emissions. We'll have climatologists Brenda Urquhart-Wurzel and Michael Mann joining us to examine these issues. Brenda is with the Union of Concerned Scientists, and Michael Mann contributed to the report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2007. Again, this coming Thursday, October the 23rd at 7:30 p.m., tackling climate change nationally and globally, free and open to the public. Join me. And joining us now is David Phillips, the Director of Peacebuilding and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University and the author of Losing Iraq Inside the Post-War Reconstruction Fiasco. He's a former senior advisor and foreign affairs expert to the U.S. Department of State during the administrations of Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama. And his latest book is The Kurdish Spring, A New Map of the Middle East, for the Middle East. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Phillips.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And so what are we to make of Turkey's apparent reversal, where now they've announced that they're going to allow Kurdish fighters to enter Kobani across the border into Syria from Turkey and perhaps weapons as well? At the same time, they're not allowing the U.S. to use the NATO airbase at Incirlik. So I guess it's what they used to say in the old Western movies. They seem to be talking with a forked tongue.
I think the key here is your use of the term apparent. Turkey did make an announcement yesterday that it would allow Peshmerga from Iraqi Kurdistan to cross its territory into Syria, but so far none have actually made the journey. It wouldn't be the first time that Turkey has made a pledge to the international coalition and then walked back from its pledge. A few weeks ago, it offered Incirlik Air Force Base and to host a train-and-equip program for the moderate Syrian opposition. There hasn't been any result to that promise either. So Turkey needs to be judged not by what it says, by what it does. Hopefully it will prove true to its word.
Well, didn't the National Security Advisor go on television recently and say that Turkey had allowed the U.S., would allow U.S. to use Incirlik, and then apparently she ended up with egg on her face?
That's right. Susan Rice went on Meet the Press, made a major announcement that this was a new commitment by Turkey. The next day, the Turkish foreign minister said there was no commitment. So it made the Obama administration look either ill-informed or confused. Actually, the problem rests in Ankara and the unpredictability of Turkey as an ally, and deep questions about whether Turkey can be counted upon as a member of the coalition, and more broadly about Turkey's membership in the NATO alliance.
So what's going on internally with the Turkey's leader? Is he in denial about the extent to which Turkey is responsible for at least facilitating the creation of the Islamic State and these radical fighters who were given safe passage into Syria through Turkey? At the same time, he's insisting that the target in Syria should be the Assad regime, not the Islamic State, apparently, which he helped facilitate.
So there are allegations swirling over several years that President Erdogan aided, abetted, offered logistical support and financing for radical Sunnis in order to enter the battlefield in Syria. You know, he and his prime minister, Davutoğlu, deny that, but there is ample evidence in Turkish media and eyewitness accounts that Turkey has been working hand in glove with ISIS, most recently as last week in Kobani. What really incited the Kurds in Turkey was a statement by President Erdogan saying that ISIS and the PKK were both terrorist organizations and should be treated the same. While the battle for Kobani is going on, you have battalions of Turkish tanks parked on the hill as spectators. It's clear that their goal here is to have as many Kurds and ISIS fighters kill each other off. What they really want is to see the Assad regime toppled, and they've attached conditions to their participation in the coalition, a no-fly zone and a buffer zone. President Obama isn't going to be coerced into supporting those positions. That's why he called Erdogan over the weekend and told him that the U.S. was going to be launching more airstrikes and dropping equipment to the Kurds in Syria and Kobani so they could join the battle more effectively.
And that's happened, apparently, and it looks as though the tide is turning. So what's your understanding of the Islamic State or ISIL's strategy there? What were they hoping to do by taking this town on the Turkish border?
So if they had controlled Kobani, they would have had a huge territory from Kobani through Anbar right to the border of Baghdad. The U.S. started off by saying that there was nothing strategic about Kobani, but the valiant struggle of the Syrian Kurds against ISIS made it a defining moment in the U.S.-led war against the Islamic State. That's why the U.S. felt compelled to intervene with airstrikes. You know, as usual, the Obama administration acted late, but just enough to turn the tide. After occupying 40% of the city of Kobani, now ISIS has been driven out. The airstrikes were critical, but the real credit belongs to the Kurdish fighters defending the city, who were incredibly heroic in turning the tide.
And a lot of these fighters are women, which apparently freaks out the Islamic State fighters, because apparently you don't go to heaven and get all the virgins if you get killed by a woman.
Yeah, if you're killed by a woman, there are no virgins on a magic carpet waiting for you. And the Kurdish women that fought in the battle were fierce and effective, and they were standing side by side with Kurds from Syria and the PKK. You know, that in and of itself is a statement about the progressive approach of Kurds to their security and to their governance.
Again, I'm speaking with David Phillips, the director of the Peace Building and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University and the author of Losing Iraq Inside the Post-War Reconstruction Fiasco. He's a former senior advisor and foreign affairs expert to the United States Department of State during the administrations of Presidents Clinton, Bush and Obama. And his latest book is The Kurdish Spring, A New Map for the Middle East. So what is it, though, that Erdogan, I mean, I'm assuming that you can't ascribe all of these, this apparent indifference to the suffering of the Syrian Kurds on the part of Turkey. You can't ascribe it all to Erdogan because he's popular. So this the the Turkish people must share some of his reservations about getting militarily involved there. At the same time, he's making these contradictory statements. On the one hand, he wants to make the focus getting rid of the Assad regime, and he also wants to conflate Islamic State terrorism with the PKK. And they have a sort of offshoot, a political offshoot, if you will, in amongst the Syrian Kurds. But is he mostly afraid about the idea that the Syrian Kurds will get the same idea that the Iraqi Kurds have now taken the ball and run with? Because the only part of Iraq that works is the Kurdish North. That's the only success story in that otherwise sad and ongoing tragedy known as Iraq.
So the Kurds in Syria declared an autonomous area, which they called Rojava. This represented a transcendent threat to Turkey because it mirrored what was happening in Iraqi Kurdistan, and potentially it would inspire Turkey's Kurds to demand something similar. You know, their political leaders are talking about a concept called democratic autonomy. But let's make no mistake about it. What's happened in Kobani has been a public relations disaster for Erdogan personally and for Turkey. And no better measure than that than the vote last week for a seat on the UN Security Council, which Turkey thought it would win handily, and it was repudiated by the UN General Assembly. Right now, members of the coalition and the international community simply don't trust Turkey. And its rejection of Turkey for that Security Council seat was a real embarrassment for Turkish diplomacy. The fact that the U.S. is launching airstrikes and dropping weapons to the Kurds in Syria within 24 hours of Erdogan referring to them as terrorists is also a repudiation of his credibility. So Turkey has lost a lot of ground. It needs to really become a credible participant in the international coalition before it regains much of the credibility that was lost.
But Erdogan also lost a lot of credibility internationally when he beat up on the students who occupied Gezi Square in Istanbul in protest to developers who were in bed with it's called the Development Party, Erdogan's party, he was pretty boneheaded about his treatment of them. He denied the fact that they actually had a point about the environment and about cronyism that seems to be afflicting Erdogan's government. So is he just boneheaded?
So Erdogan's democracy credentials were deeply tarnished by what happened in Gezi Park, which is the incident that you refer to. And those protests spread to 60 cities. But it wasn't a good year for Erdogan. After that, there were corruption allegations. There were tapes surfaced of him and his son talking about stashing millions of dollars. Members of his cabinet were forced to resign in a corruption scandal. He visited a town in western Turkey where there was a mining disaster and essentially mocked the families. At the same time, there was legislation to improve mining safety that his party blocked in the parliament. So there's just an example over the past 18 months of one political blunder after another by Tayyip Erdogan and his party. Remarkably, in the middle of all this, he ran for president, and he won with a majority of the vote. They didn't even have to go to a runoff. It goes to show, you know, how the distribution of assets to his core Islamist supporters is such an important part of Turkish politics today.
So is there ambivalence both with Erdogan and his supporters over the Islamic State? I mean, where do they draw the line in this world where we're still trying to define the sort of the fissure between moderate Islam and radical Islam?
So Erdogan is quite adamant that there's no support coming from the Turkish government for ISIS. But a month ago, the deputy prime minister of Turkey made a statement that women in Turkey shouldn't be seen smiling or laughing in public because it draws attention to themselves. The fact of the matter is that the AK party of Tayyip Erdogan and ISIS are ideologically and spiritually united. They may use different tactics. AKP isn't going around chopping people's heads off. But they have the exact same worldview. And that's where the internal conflict comes for Erdogan. He's under enormous pressure from the U.S. and the international community to confront ISIS. But in fact, you know, he and ISIS have been in bed together for some time, and there's still a sense of loyalty to their mission. That's why Turkey can't be counted on as a reliable ally.
So what's your sense then of whether the pressure will mount on him? I mean, given that he embarrassed the Obama administration, I mean, I don't know whether how much Susan Rice got out ahead of herself or whether she was told something that by the Turks that they then reneged on. But it just doesn't make any sense that you're a member of NATO. There's a NATO base there. The U.S. has to fly from carriers in the Gulf and from the air base in Doha and refuel, etc., to bomb the Islamic State. And as far as I know, that's the only part of the coalition, the anti-ISIS coalition, that everybody agrees on, including Turkey and Saudi Arabia, is that they don't like ISIS. But they don't seem to agree on anything else, and there's no strategy beyond that.
So it was clearly a misunderstanding between Turkish officials and U.S. negotiators about an agreement for the use of Incirlik Air Force Base. I don't think that the U.S. officials got it wrong. I think that Turkey made a commitment that they realized for domestic political reasons that they just couldn't fulfill. So Turkey needs to make some very important decisions. Does it want to be outside the tent, ostracized for its support to ISIS, or does it want to be a part of the coalition, work closely with the United States, implement greater political and cultural rights for its Kurds, and solve its Kurdish question once and for all? Now, the jury is still out on which direction Turkey is going to go. But it's important to note that NATO is not only a security alliance. NATO is an alliance of countries with shared values. And membership in NATO requires certain democratic standards. Given the fact that Erdogan's democracy credentials are so tarnished, and he's inciting unrest among Turkey's Kurds, there are going to be some serious questions raised about Turkey's future viability as a member of NATO.
So how much does he care then about international opinion and U.S. opinion?
He wants to be a leader of the Sunni world. You know, he sees himself as a pasha. He wants to rival Ataturk in the history of Turkey. He can't do that by looking inward. And he can't do that by looking solely to the Muslim world. He needs to regain his standing with the West. It's important that Erdogan recognize that the U.S., Turkey, and the Kurds are essentially all in this battle together, that we're all on the same side, and that Turkey needs to be counted as a friend and ally. If Turkey drops the ball and fails to take on ISIS, it will be a further discredit for Turkey and for Erdogan and raise serious questions about U.S.-Turkey cooperation going forward.
Well, you'd think, though, that Incirlik would be the the yardstick by which Erdogan is judged.
Absolutely. Incirlik is 100 kilometers from the front line. It was used in Operation Northern Watch and Operation Provide Comfort after the Gulf War. If these technical issues that seem to be holding up the agreement on the use of Incirlik aren't addressed immediately, then one can only assume that the problem isn't technical, the problem is political. And if Erdogan is refusing to make a deal on Incirlik, then he really can't be trusted in any sense and in any form of cooperation.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, David Phillips.
Thank you very much, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with David Phillips, who's the director of the Peace Building and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University and the author of Losing Iraq: Inside the Post-War Reconstruction Fiasco. He's a former senior advisor and foreign affairs expert to the United States Department of State during the administrations of Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama. And his latest book is The Kurdish Spring: A New Map for the Middle East. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about the exaggerated fear and paranoia being stoked by the media over two cases of Ebola in the United States. And joining us now is Roxanne Silver, who's a professor of psychology and social behavior, medicine, and public health at the University of California, Irvine, where she researches the psychological effects of media consumption. Welcome to Background Briefing, Roxanne Silver.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And we have this sort of paradox now that politicians who say, I'm not a scientist on climate, who are in many ways denying global warming and climate change, are freely offering up their advice on Ebola. And the media seems to have been beating the drum to the point where schools are closing out of completely ridiculous fears that an Ebola outbreak is imminent, when we only have two people in the United States, one of whom is dead, that's been affected by Ebola. And yet, you know, all this hysteria in the United States is missing the focus, which is the 5,000 people who've died in West Africa. And that's where the outbreak began. That's where it has to be contained. And that's where our focus should be. There's something crazy going on here.
Well, there are a number of issues, I think, surrounding the current Ebola crisis, and I want to put crisis in quotes, in the United States. The risk of getting an infection from Ebola is about 3 people in over 300 million. Those are the statistics that the scientists give us. Obviously, the rates of infection are quite a bit higher in West Africa, where the current Ebola outbreak began. The situation in the United States is one that, as you said, has been, there have been very few people that have been infected. I think it's two now, two nurses, as well as the man who came from Liberia. I think that we are seeing quite a bit of media attention directed toward the Ebola crisis. And as you rightly point out, the current attention from the media is now on the potential for infection in the United States, and in recent weeks certainly has not focused on what's going on in Africa.
So tell us about the work that you've done in terms of looking at researching the psychological effects of media consumption, particularly as they relate to comparisons that have been made in a New York Times article that quotes you with the anthrax attacks of 2001, the West Nile virus outbreak in New York City of 1999, and in the particular, the work that you've done on the Boston Marathon bombing, where you found that individuals who were exposed to a great deal of media within the first weeks reported more acute stress than did people who were actually at the marathon bombing.
Yes, that is correct. We actually began our focus on the impact of the media after September 11th. In the in the first week after the 9/11 terrorist attacks, we assessed in a sample of several thousand people, a representative sample across the United States, the extent to which people were being exposed to repeated images and stories about the September 11th terrorist attacks. We followed people for several years, and we found that individuals who had watched a great deal of television at the time, back in 2001, were at increased risk for psychological and physical ailments 3 years later. That alerted us to the possibility that television, and again, that was the primary source of news back in 2001, we were alerted to the possibility that television was the conduit through which stress was dispersed broadly across the United States. And after September 11th, there were signs that people in other countries, in particular in the UK, were impacted by the media attention that was focused on 9/11. When the Boston Marathon bombing happened, we decided, my colleagues and I, decided that we would look to see what the impact of media might be in the early aftermath of the Boston Marathon bombing, because now we're talking not only a 24/7 media cycle on television, but we now have a great deal of social media that has been added to the mix, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, those sorts of opportunities to be exposed to the media. And in fact, now people are carrying around the media and their purses are in their pockets in the form of their smartphones. So we were particularly intrigued about the possibility that people were being bombarded with pictures about the Boston Marathon and what might be the psychological impact. We in fact found that individuals who were exposed to a great deal of media, in particular about on average 6 hours a day, were at increased risk, several times more likely to be expressing acute stress reactions within the first week or two after the Boston Marathon bombing than having been at the marathon or knowing somebody who was injured at the marathon or having been in the lockdown. Now, when we talk about 6 hours a day, we're not talking about somebody who is sitting in front of a television for 6 hours a day. In fact, the average amount of media to which people were exposed in our representative sample was about 4.5 hours a day. So people may be watching TV for a couple of hours. Maybe they're listening to the radio. Maybe they're checking Facebook on and off throughout the day. They're looking at Twitter feeds. They're looking at online news sources. And that constant exposure, repeated exposure, was a very strong trigger of a stress reaction after the Boston Marathon. A few weeks ago, I started to think that what we were seeing about Ebola was going to follow the same pattern. And certainly, I came across an study over the weekend that indicated, it was a Kaiser Family Foundation study, that indicated that the Ebola crisis has become the number one source media story in October of 2014.
Again, I'm speaking with Roxanne Silver, who's a professor of psychology and social behavior, medicine, and public health at the University of California, Irvine, where she researches the psychological effects of media consumption. So I mentioned in the beginning, Roxanne, of the disconnect between politicians, Republican politicians, who say that they who are ducking global warming as an issue, saying that they're not qualified scientifically to discuss whether global warming is real or not, but they consider themselves qualified to say that the U.S. should institute a travel ban on West Africa. Why then is there this sense that, and it is of course so unscientific, that we're exaggerating the possibility of an Ebola outbreak here, where one person's died and two nurses have been infected? And by the way, I talked recently to an expert on Ebola and bio warfare, as a matter of fact, and a couple of experts actually pointed out that a contributing factor here to the fact that this Ebola outbreak, for what if that's not too strong a word, since it involves two nurses, it's also in part because of our medical system here in the United States, the fact that Governor Perry of Texas has refused Medicare funding, which has created an enormous underclass of people in Texas that are not being served. And this gentleman who went in from West Africa to the hospital went to the emergency room, which is already overwhelmed now because Perry basically won't take the federal money, and he's dumping millions of Texans into the emergency system. So it seems to me that we're not really having a rational discussion about what the real problems are. One, that we're not focusing on that the real problem is in West Africa. And two, we're not focusing on why it is that this outbreak, if you can call it that, happened here in the United States.
Well, I have two comments. First, as a psychologist, part of what you're asking about or commenting about is outside of my area of expertise. But I will say that I have colleagues in public health who convey the fact that the outbreak occurred in West Africa is the consequence of many years of war in West Africa and a very impoverished medical system. And that's why a place like Nigeria was able to I guess they've determined today or over the weekend that Nigeria is now free of the Ebola virus, but certain countries, Liberia, for example, Sierra Leone, are not, and that may be, and again, this is the message that my public health colleagues conveyed to me, that may be a consequence of years of war. What we are, I think it's important to also to acknowledge, and this comes from my decision science research colleagues, in particular a colleague of mine, Baruch Fischoff, points out that what we've got going on right now in the United States is also a communications problem. We have the risk communications has not been accurately or effectively communicated. The message that most Americans are not at risk of catching Ebola has not been adequately communicated by the scientists. I think that it requires people to understand that a person, that the virus is not airborne, that there's a person is only infectious when they have symptoms, that infectious period ends after 21 days. There are many things that those of us who have read the scientific literature know makes the risk of an outbreak in the United States as close as what one could get to zero. Again, of course, it's not zero, and there have been missteps made in the communication of that information. But it's a very, very complicated message. And importantly, I think the media has been, I would say, somewhat responsible for the current panic, there really is panic, but it is really a communications failure from the infectious disease specialists. Not that they haven't tried, but the messaging that's been coming down has been mixed.
Well, there's no question, though, that a lot of the politicians in this country are not being helpful. I mentioned Governor Perry in Texas, who's been grandstanding on this issue. At the same time, in many ways, he helped create the desperate situation at that hospital, to the extent to which he's refused the Medicare money because he's running for president, and anything to do with Obamacare is toxic. So therefore, millions of Texans, poor Texans, are denied health care and have to rely on emergency medicine and going to the emergency room. And that's what happened to this fellow from Liberia. And clearly, the people that work there are overwhelmed, and two of them are infected. I don't know whether I'm making a reasonable case there, but it seems to me to be that seems to be an aspect of it. And I just got back from Australia, where the Australian Prime Minister, who's kind of a throwback to George W. Bush, has been beating the drum about Ebola and bombing ISIS, and that's been headline news over there. And you get the distinct impression that politicians would rather grandstand and stoke the hysteria rather than deal with the problem.
Well, I've certainly read quotes that seemed highly misinformed by individuals saying that we have to close our southern border because individuals who are coming across the southern border are bringing Ebola with them. I mean, there's quite a bit of, I think, grandstanding from a number of people. This crisis can, or again, I want to put the word crisis in the United States in quotes, it serves a lot of people's purposes at the moment. We're unfortunately right in the midst of an election cycle, which makes this to be particularly a hot topic for politicians. But again, the messaging needs to come down that this is an extraordinarily unlikely event for an outbreak in the United States, and I do want to comment. You said that the nurses in the hospital in Texas were overwhelmed. I think that there was some lack of preparation across the United States in the messaging about how the nurses should protect themselves. I think that because of what happened in Dallas, that other hospitals across the country are going to be more prepared, which makes it even more unlikely that we will see an outbreak here, fortunately for us.
And of course, it wasn't helpful that the first victim who brought the Ebola to the United States, Thomas Eric Duncan, lied to the authorities in Liberia several times and should not have been allowed on that plane. But as you pointed out, Liberia is a failed state that's been in decades of civil war. So just in closing then, it's often said about the media, and particularly the evening news, if it bleeds, it leads. And if you came in from Mars and watched the average evening news broadcast here in the United States, you'd think that America was the most violent, screwed-up country in the world, with random violence everywhere, missing children, people crossing borders with diseases, kidnapping, all kinds of, every crime that takes place in this vast urban area here in Los Angeles, there's a certain proportionality lost because the focus is on it. And so,
I do want to say that I'm not merely talking about television, because again, we're not only seeing these kinds of hysterical reports on television. It's across the internet, it's across Twitter, it's across Facebook. And so as people gain more of their news outside of the television in so-called social media, I think we also have to acknowledge that information is completely uncensored, unfiltered, and the people are bombarded with this information from all different sources of media.
And are you also saying that there isn't an adult who can just calm everybody down an authority figure that can?
I certainly think that there could be repeated messaging from a number of people, from a number of respected politicians, scientists, that could continue to alert people to the likelihood that this is completely overblown. Again, we're now, as you point out, in the middle of a political time where I think you couldn't just get a Democrat to make that case. It would have to be both a Democrat or a Republican, or hopefully a Democrat and Republican standing at a microphone together saying, listen, folks, this is a rare event, and this hysteria is unwarranted.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Roxanne Silva.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Roxanne Silva, who's a professor of psychology and social behavior, medicine, and public health at the University of California, Irvine, where she researches the psychological effects of media consumption. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into why Turkey has been so reluctant to get militarily involved in Syria. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Henri Barkey, who's a professor of international relations at Lehigh University. He served as a member of the U.S. State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence, and has authored, co-authored, and edited 5 books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller and Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East. He has an article at The American Interest, The Meaning of Kobani. Welcome to Background Briefing, Henri Barkey.
Thank you.
And it seems that Turkey seems to have relented today. They're suggesting now that they will allow Kurds to cross into the Kurdish fighters to cross into Kobani and into Syria from Turkey, and arms to come in as well. What's the extent of this change of heart?
Well, I think this is damage control. I mean, the Turks have been caught a little bit flat-footed. They they thought that they could convince the Americans not to support the Kurds in Kobani and not support the defense of Kobani because the Turks don't want the Syrian Kurds to assume the same gains that Iraqi Kurds have, i.e. that is an autonomous zone in Syria. So because Turkey has its own Kurdish problem that it's trying to resolve, and it thinks that where the Syrian Kurds will succeed, like the Iraqi Kurds, that it will be very, very difficult then to contain Turkish Kurds because the Turkish Kurds will demand the same things. But more importantly, I think the Turks thought that the United States would heed their call, but for a number of reasons, the administration is very angry at Turkey at the moment. And there was also the fact that in Kobani, the American military suddenly realized that they can inflict on ISIS or the Islamic State a very severe, not necessarily defeat, but certainly inflict enormous amount of damage on ISIS, because ISIS made kind of a strategic calculation that it needed to take Kobani, so it poured enormous amount of resources, both men and equipment. So it became a target-rich environment for the U.S. military, and the U.S. military decided that here you have Kurds who are defending Kobani, who are doing a pretty good job, but they needed help. And between the Kurds and the U.S. Air Force, you can really deal ISIS an important blow, and that would help morale in the region and show that ISIS is not, you know, this kind of 100 feet tall giant, and it can be taken down. But the Turks tried to play very hard ball with the United States. The United States has been asking Turkey to give access to the large air force base in southern Turkey called Incirlik, which is very close to both Syria and Iraq, so that the United States could conduct airstrikes from that base. At the moment,
which is a NATO base, I might add. It's a NATO base.
That's correct. And at the moment, American aircraft have to come from either the Persian Gulf from carriers or from the base in Doha, which means that they don't have enough time to hover around the targets. They need to be resupplied, refueled in the air. So using the Turkish base is a no-brainer. But the Turks have made it very difficult. And the United States last, not this weekend, but the weekend before, thought it had a deal with the Turks. And Susan Rice went on national television and said, yes, we have a deal with the Turks. And then the Turks said, no, we don't have a deal. So there's a combination of things that have soured America's relationship with Turkey. And today the Turks were in some ways obliged to do something, because the perception out there is everybody's trying to save Kobani, everybody's trying to save the Kurds, except the Turks. Then the Turks seem aligned with ISIS, even though they're not aligned with ISIS, but that's the perception that they've created for themselves, so they needed to do something. And they're letting not Turkish Kurds, but Iraqi Kurds cross the border. But it is like, as I said, a stopgap, damage control attempt by the Turkish government to show that it is doing something. But it's important. I mean, that Kurdish fighters joined the fight because you do need bodies to fight. But it's a little bit too late. They should have done this a long time ago.
Again, I'm speaking with Ori Barkey, who's a professor of international relations at Lehigh University. He served as a member of the U.S. State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence, and has authored, co-authored, and edited 5 books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller and Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East. And he has an article at The American Interest, The Meaning of Kobani. Well, the Turks, I think, not only are taking a hit in the United States in terms, I mean, it's pretty unsupportable what they're doing, where they're literally Turkish soldiers and tanks are standing on the border looking at Kurds being slaughtered Kurdish fighters are being outgunned. I think also I just returned from Australia, where I've been for the last couple of weeks, and the impression you get there on the television is equally damning of the Turks. They're not coming out of this looking very good, and their excuses are saying, you know, we want the U.S. to guarantee that they're going to still want to take down Assad, and we want a universal declaration against all terrorism, obviously referring to the PKK. In the face of this tragedy, it seems, small stuff.
Well, look, it is quite understandable that they do not want to join the fight themselves. Yes, they've arrayed all those tanks and all that equipment against on the border, and all these guys are watching essentially what's going on in the border town of Kobani on the other side. That said, Turkey has many reasons why it does not want to get in. If it goes into Syria, it doesn't know what it will be facing. There's potentially in the Syrian military, the Kurds, ISIS, and the Turkish military is not really very well equipped to undertake this kind of operation. So the Turks, for a long time, have made it clear that they're not going to go into Syria militarily. That's perfectly fine. That's understandable. We are saying exactly the same thing, that we're not going to put boots on the ground. So, I mean, every country has its own calculation, but don't stop another country from, especially an ally who's asking you for the use of a base, don't stop them from doing something that is so necessary. But fundamentally, there is a major divergence of objectives between the United States and Turkey, and we need to understand that. For Turkey, the primary threat or the primary goal, it's not a threat, but primary goal is the overthrow of Bashar al-Assad in Syria. For the United States, the primary goal is ISIS. And not because of what ISIS is doing in Turkey, but what ISIS has, I'm sorry, in Syria, but because of what ISIS represents as a threat in Iraq. Iraq is far more important than Syria for the United States. But in Kobani, I mean, the United States is partially defending the Kurds, but partially it's trying to deal, as I said earlier, ISIS a major blow. But that fundamental difference of objectives between Turkey and the United States is irreconcilable. And because of that, we will continue to see a great deal of acrimony, if you want, between Turkey and the United States. President Erdogan yesterday, coming back from a trip to from Afghanistan, gave an interview to journalists where he made it very clear that he has four conditions for opening up the base to the United States, and the four conditions include two that are three of which are complete non-starters. One, the creation of a no-fly zone over Syria, or northern Syria. The creation of safe havens in Syrian territory, which means you need to put boots on the ground, right? And three, military operations against Assad. The United States has made it clear this is not what it wants to do. It will not do it. This administration has come to power on a platform of getting out of the Middle East, not going back into the Middle East. So both countries, the leadership in both countries, have their own political and military objectives, and they don't seem to be aligned very well. That doesn't mean the United States and Turkey are not allies today, but the Turkish government rhetoric has been quite harsh, and whereas the Obama administration has always tried to be quite conciliatory towards Turkey, when you read and listen to what President Erdogan is saying about the West, United States, about Syria, I mean, it's always blaming everything on the West and always saying that the West is not doing enough. Well, in some ways, if there is a problem today with the jihadists, it is not completely, but it is partially Turkey's doing, because the Turks at one point basically opened their borders to any jihadists who wanted to cross into Syria. These were not necessarily ISIS people, but eventually they may have joined ISIS. So there is responsibility here that everybody should take on everybody's shoulder. But the Turks' attitude has been so negative that I think the White House has said enough. I mean, the fact that the White House decided to support militarily the Kurds in Syria is actually quite interesting. President Obama called Erdogan on Saturday night, and I could not figure out why it is that Obama was calling him, because all the relationship with Erdogan had been essentially outsourced to Vice President Biden. And then yesterday, when I heard that America was now parachuting supplies, I realized that he called Erdogan to tell him precisely that that he was going to do that.
That the U.S. is parachuting in ammunition and weapons to the besieged Kurdish fighters in Kobani. And apparently, as you pointed out earlier, ISIS or the Islamic State made a strategic miscalculation, and they've allowed themselves to become a target-rich environment for the United States Air Force, who are bombing them. So what was the strategy then, if you can put yourself in the minds and of the strategists on the side of the Islamic State? What were they trying to achieve?
You're asking me a very question. I mean, look, I think, here's what happened, I think. When you look at the location of the ISIS assault, it is in the middle of the three cantons, as the Syrian Kurds call their region. I mean, they've created three different cantons. So my sense is that the ISIS wanted to take the one in the middle, because you take the one in the middle, then the other two would fall much more easily. Once the Syrian Kurds started to resist, right, then ISIS decided to make an example, if you want, of this town, and decided to pull. I don't think they ever expected that the United States Air Force would intervene so heavily, because the United States never had any relationship with the Syrian Kurds, with the Syrian Kurdish party called the PYD. And so they assumed that the Americans will not come to the defense of the PYD. And what is interesting, of course, is that the PYD and the United States, long before the supply operation started yesterday, started to exchange information. Because when you have American aircraft bombing a location, you need somebody to tell you where the targets are. You need somebody to identify targets. So what I suspect happened is that the Americans probably maybe even supplied the relevant equipment to the Syrian Kurds so that they could pinpoint where ISIS positions were and the American Air Force could bomb them. And in fact, you see that the pace of air operations or bombing runs against ISIS increased dramatically in the days coming to this past weekend, which meant that there was much better coordination between the PYD and the United States. I think this is something that ISIS did not bank on. I think ISIS did not expect this. And by the time this started to happen, of course, they were already committed to capturing Kobani. And let's not forget that 2 weeks ago, ISIS forces were inside Kobani. They had already penetrated the outside defenses. They had inserted themselves in some of the neighborhoods. So they were on the verge of victory, and therefore the fact that they are being beaten back is quite serious for them. And so that was the error. But I can't tell you for sure that this is what they had in mind. That was their strategy. I mean, I'm only guessing. I cannot really put myself in their shoes and think this one through.
Well, just in closing then, it does seem that Turkey is being somewhat hypocritical here. On the one hand, they want America to get more active militarily against Assad. At the same time, they won't let America use a NATO base. And what is it that Turkey's doing militarily? They're the ones that created half of this problem by turning a blind eye to ISIS and the radicals.
Remember that the base is, Nazis wants to use the base not against Assad, but against ISIS.
Yes, against ISIS.
The Turks feel perfectly
right.
content by saying no.
But what is it that Turkey is doing militarily while they're complaining the Americans aren't doing enough? They're not doing anything.
Well, the Turks and the Americans are collaborating on training now the rebels, a new bunch of rebels. They did in the past support all kinds of rebels, both the moderates and the jihadists. But look, I mean, Turkey doesn't want to go into militarily. I think as popular as Erdogan may be in Turkey, if he were to go into Syria militarily, he would lose enormous amount of support at home. There is no stomach in Turkey today for a foreign military adventure. And so he's in that sense hamstrung. He cannot engage the Syrian regime militarily from a political perspective. And he actually doesn't want to. He doesn't want to give his officers, his generals, any more cachet that he doesn't want. And there are some in Turkey who think that, you know, the Turkish army going into Syria, it is such a unknown territory that it will be impossible for the Turks to do a good, militarily to do a good job. So it's a lose-lose situation for them. And I understand completely why they don't want to go in militarily. And look, we went into Iraq militarily, we defeated the Iraqi army, and look what happened afterwards.
Right.
So, well, so it's not as if we are any better than anybody else.
Sure. Well, Henri Bakke, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Henri Bakke. He's professor of international relations at Lehigh University. He served as a member of the U.S. State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence, and has authored, co-authored, and edited 5 books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller and Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East. He has an article at the American Interest, The Meaning of Kobani. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. One more life.